Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Zoe Wool. She's an anthropologist who studies war-injured American soldiers returning from Afghanistan and Iraq and their struggles to adjust and adapt. Her fieldwork was done at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C., and Fort Dix in New Jersey, as well as Landstuhl Regional Medical Center in Germany. Dr. Wool earned her Ph.D. at the University of Toronto, and she's currently a postdoctoral fellow at Rutgers University's Institute for Health, Healthcare Policy, and Aging Research. Zoe, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
I want to start with a very general question. What's the most important thing about these returning veterans' experiences that Americans have not been made aware of through the traditional media?
That's a great question, and it's actually something that I wouldn't have known the answer to if I hadn't spent quite a long time getting to know these guys. One of the things that they really seem to value the most about my being there as an anthropologist, particularly at Walter Reed, where there are so many journalists and volunteers and politicians coming through, is that I was there to try and understand their experience without a particular political frame. And without a particular narrative bent. I wasn't interested in a story of heroism. I wasn't interested in a particular story of overcoming medical odds. And so I think the thing that's the most surprising to people is how ordinary life continues to be, even for soldiers who have these really intense kinds of physical injuries and, you know, other kinds of less visible injuries.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that later. I'll ask it now because I noticed that in reading some of your stuff that you talk about this sense of ordinariness that the soldiers have about their lives in the midst of what everybody who's looking at them from the outside thinks is anything but ordinary. So say more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Walter Reed in particular has a very domestic flavor to it. The soldiers who are there have family members with them. Often it's a wife or a girlfriend. Sometimes it's a parent or a cousin or a brother who is there for most of the time, the period that they're there, which is an average of about 14 months. But there were guys who I worked with there for about 3 years. And life continues. The ordinary struggles of a young relationship, the trials and tribulations of living all of a sudden with your parents after you've been part of an army unit deployed overseas in combat, all of those things continue. And the struggles that they present are intensified, certainly, but they give life there a certain ordinary quality that gives it a continuity with the past and also the idea that the future could be ordinary, too. And then on top of that, there's also a different kind of ordinariness that's shared only among the people who are living in a place like Walter Reed. The daily routines of appointments, the presence of journalists and those things I was talking about before, people sort of get used to them and find a way to incorporate them into their daily life. And they have a particular understanding of them that they share with other soldiers. And that itself also becomes really, really important.
Well, you've written and spoken about these recovering soldiers, and this is related to this, I think, question of ordinariness, being confronted by dominant cultural views regarding war and sacrifice mm-hmm. that are very powerful, but that they themselves don't always find to be authentic or accurate in thinking about their own lives. And then they're asked to actively participate by others in those views because that's what those folks need to have. Can you tell me more about that?
It's an exceptionally challenging thing for soldiers to negotiate, and on the whole, they do it really well. But most of the guys, and I say guys because most of the people who I worked with were young men, and I also say soldiers because most of them were in the Army, but these things will probably be true to varying degrees for female soldiers and probably also for other service members, Marines and people in the Navy. Most of them joined the military not because they wanted to fight for freedom, not because they were devoted patriots and wanted to leave family behind, but just for all of the reasons that we often hear people make any kind of major life decision, right? They wanted money to go for school. They were kind of stuck in their lives, and the military seemed like the best option to get them out of the difficulties that they were facing, or to offer them some kind of independence or chance for a future. And that is very different than this idea that you get in really well-meaning expressions of gratitude, where the idea there is soldiers have sacrificed everything on behalf of the nation, when that wasn't their intention, right? People didn't sign up for the military to sacrifice everything on behalf of the nation. And so while the guys who I worked with were very happy to have a certain kind of recognition for the difficulty that they have gone through, which is, of course, done in a national context, to have somebody come up to you on the street and see that you have two prosthetic limbs and say thank you to you is a very complicated thing, in part because it erases the violence that has been inflicted on you. It erases the difficulty of the violence that you have inflicted on others. And it creates this kind of vague idea of sacrifice and moral debt. And it's a real challenge.
Is it also part of the dynamic that, thinking of some things from other walks of life, that the folks that are coming, the example that you gave, the folks coming up to that wounded veteran, they want to feel good in a way about what they're looking at, about this experience. And in the sense, then, they're asking, without even perhaps being aware of it, that wounded veteran to help them out with that. And that's what that dynamic is about. And then they have to, in a sense, take care of this other person in addition to themselves.
Absolutely, yeah. And one of the soldiers who I worked with, often the soldiers at Walter Reed, when they meet a volunteer or a politician for the first time, the first thing that people often ask them is, what happened to you? Which is really an inappropriate thing to ask, right? I mean, the soldiers who I worked with had been blown up in improvised explosive device explosions in Iraq. And this is an incredibly painful thing and something that they're in the process of grappling with. Some of them are just a few weeks after their injury. Some of them are a few years after their injury. But to ask what happened to you, I mean, this is a big question. And the guys who I worked with had these very funny, pithy, often sort of over-the-top, gruesome ways of telling their injury stories. And I sat down with one of the guys who I came to know the best, and he had agreed to tell me the story. And when I asked him to tell me the story, he told me something very different, which was a version of the story that in our conversation afterwards he came to call the sincere version. And it was a version that took place over a very long period of time. It started from when he went outside the wire, when he left the forward operating base in Iraq where he had been. It went through the injury event, which was rolling over an improvised explosive device that had a trigger in the road. It went through his being medically evacuated out of Iraq and then waking up at Walter Reed. And it was very slow. It was very difficult for him to tell. It was full of silences and long pauses. As he described this story to me, he talked about being able to feel in the present moment as he was speaking to me some of the sensations that he had felt then, sand being blown up in his face, the heat of his skin burning inside of this vehicle as he was trying to get out. And when I asked him after he told me this story, why he chose to tell me this story and why he chose to tell this other story to volunteers and all of these other people who came through, he said exactly what you suggested, which is that sometimes he thinks when people ask him that, they want him to show them that everything is okay, that he's okay, and that the violence of war is not as bad as we think, that we don't need to take it too seriously. And it's a difficult position for him to be in because, of course, he takes it so seriously. And yet, to turn around and tell that story to somebody, he said he was afraid people would be disgusted. He didn't think people really wanted to listen. But at the same time, to say to someone, I'm not going to tell you that story because I don't think you really want to hear it, is a kind of aggressive and challenging move. And in the current climate, when we can move very quickly from thinking about soldiers as heroes to thinking about soldiers as violent villains, to do something like say, I'm not going to tell you, I don't think you want to hear it, to make that kind of aggressive move, can have real consequences for how people treat you and think about you and all soldiers.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Zoe Wool, an anthropologist who writes about the experiences of returning wounded veterans. Well, you've also written about the solitude and the aloneness experienced by these folks. Can you say a little bit about that?
Sure. Particularly at Walter Reed, which is, you know, where the majority of my fieldwork is and most of what I write about happened there, there's a lot of – soldiers have a lot of time on their hands. They spend a lot of time at appointments, waiting in lines to fill out paperwork. But they also have large portions of the day where their time is totally unstructured and they're just there with a family member killing time. And because there isn't a unit structure that requires soldiers to be together in the way that there is in normal army life, soldiers end up spending a lot of time alone. They may sit around and play video games or watch movies. And sometimes, you know, they do things together. They work on cars together. They go to the mall together. But there's a fair amount of alone time that happens. And there is concern. There was concern at Walter Reed when I was there, and I think there still is concern, that solitude can go too far, that solitude can be related. It can be a harbinger of potential suicide, which is the main concern. And so, for example, there was a policy at Walter Reed that soldiers were not allowed to spend the night alone. And there's a line there between solitude, which is sometimes required by soldiers who are dealing with things that it's very difficult for them to be able to explain, and surrounded by people who are urgently waiting for them to explain these things that are so hard to explain. So sometimes retreating into yourself, being alone, and doing something like playing a video game can offer a certain kind of solace. So there's sometimes a tension between solitude as a dangerous thing and solitude as a thing that can actually be life-preserving. And so I'm really interested in thinking about both sides of solitude.
There's a great concern about the high suicide rates among these veterans. What do you think's going on there?
There's a lot of things going on there. Part of it, historically, the suicide rate in the military, all across the military, has been lower than the civilian suicide rate, something that the military has historically been very proud of. And often that's attributed to the fact that you have to meet certain requirements of mental health and, you know, criminal record and all kinds of things in order to get into the military in the first place. What I think is going on there with the suicide rate is pretty much what the Army itself has recognized is going on with the suicide rate in two very large reports that were released, one in 2010 and one just this year, which is there's a whole context of risky behaviors, intense pressures and stresses that come along with the current shape of military deployment today. So there's this thing that's called op tempo or operational tempo, which is about how quickly soldiers have to be going out to the field of combat, the theater of war, how long their dwell time or the time that they have home in between deployments is, the fact that they may be going on repeated deployments, which was almost unheard of during Vietnam. And you also have the fact that a lot of these soldiers are very, very young. There's intensive targeted recruitment in high schools. And so a lot of people join right out of high school or through the delayed entry program. They can sign up for a contract when they're 17, so before they're even allowed to vote. And you have an intensely stressful environment, a kind of compression of life experiences, some of the good experiences of life, but also a lot of the bad experiences of life, difficult relationships, financial problems, substance abuse, and being responsible for the life and death of other people, and seeing some of your best friends die or be seriously injured, and having all of these things happen, you know, within the course of just a few years, right? And then add on to that the fact that you may be moving, you may be uprooted from your social network, from the community that you know. You get this new community, but it's a community of people that are coming and going all the time also. It's incredibly difficult. And that combined with the really intense emphasis on independence and on being able to suck it up and drive on, as they say, has exacerbated the problem of suicide. It's something that the Army in particular is paying attention to. I am concerned about the way that they're paying attention to it, because the main reason, the main sort of great hope across the Army command that they're kind of trying to put forward in these two reports that I mentioned has to do with increasing discipline. There are all kinds of other things that they're trying to do. In September, there was a stand down day where activity stopped across the Army, and they did a suicide awareness training, and there are all kinds of programs. I got to see a chaplain do some briefings on suicide prevention when I was at Fort Dix that make people aware of the signs of suicide. And they have a program called the Battle Buddy Program, where you're supposed to look out for the soldier who's your buddy and kind of be vigilant for these signs. But that doesn't help all of these problems of op tempo. It doesn't help this compression of life stresses.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and my guest is Zoe Wool, a researcher who studies returning wounded American soldiers. Is there one particular soldier's story that has stuck with you more than the others? You told me one earlier. Is that the one, or is there another one?
There are some common themes that really stick with me, and I think of two soldiers who really embodied them in particular, but both of them it was very important to them to be good husbands and be good fathers. And that was something that became even more important after their injuries, because there is this idea that the future ordinary life that you're going to have should look as much like a quote-unquote normal American man's life as possible. And they were really invested in those ideas. It was really important to them to be providers for their family, to be, good, caring, loving fathers to their young children. And these are guys who are very young, in their early 20s. And to see them go through these struggles, their lives, their bodies, their social attachments to their wives were so precarious, and their whole future was invested in being able to maintain their marriages, which were sometimes really not very good. Sometimes they were in almost or actually abusive relationships where they were being mistreated by their wives. But it felt like giving up on that was giving up on the possibility of a future life. And that's also something it might be surprising for people to hear. But it's really more than these questions of patriotism and sacrifice, more than questions of national recognition. From my perspective as an anthropologist, looking at the day-to-day struggles that they had, those were the things that really were at the heart of the matter.
And how has this experience of studying these folks changed you?
I thought before I began this work that I didn't have any connection to the military. And then before my first time going on a military base, which was when I was at Larmsee at Landstuhl, I realized that my best friend's father had been a medic in Vietnam. And I realized that my English grandfather had served during World War II. And I realized that, in fact, I had all of these connections to the military. And the more I got to know people who were serving, the more I realized that this line we often hear, that Americans today are disconnected from the military, that they're not personally invested in the decisions that are being made about the military and in the violence that's being committed in the contexts of war, that this is a kind of convenient excuse. That all of us, if we stop and think about it for a minute, and it happens to me all the time in casual conversations, we know people who know people who are in the military. We have neighbors whose brothers have been killed. We have cousins who are thinking of joining the Marines. We're all connected in this way. And it really drove home for me the idea that the problem of political disengagement with questions of the military doesn't need to be there. It's not based on any empirical disconnect. We are all invested. We just don't recognize it.
Well, let me get to the three questions at the end. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
I think the title of the chapter of life I'm currently living would be History in Context. I'm very interested in the historical resonances between the work that I've recently done and the deeper history of, for example, neurology in France. I think it brings together some of my own personal interests in my own family history with my research interests. And I've become very interested in thinking about history and its resonances in the present. And I see that in my own life. And I see it certainly in the lives of the soldiers who I worked with. I guess that would be the title. Although I like puns, so I would probably come up with a better actual title if it was an actual chapter.
Second, what's your worst trait?
My worst trait is I'm prone to flights of abstraction, I think. I work on an issue that is very important to a lot of people, and I like to think very deeply about it. And I do this with other things in my life. I do it with food. I do it with all kinds of things. And I find myself sometimes floating into abstraction and becoming inaccessible to the people who I really want to talk to. So I think that that's probably my worst trait.
And finally, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
Well, it could be the fact that I'm an academic at all. I came very close to dropping out of high school, or at least being encouraged to leave the high school where I was. I did not get very good grades. I was always engaged in the world around me, but not in a way that seemed to fit, any kind of institutional parameters. I think, my ability to engage in the complicated systems that we have to engage in as academics, to be on committees or to, peer review articles and that kind of thing. I don't think I ever would have known that I had the chops to do that.
That was Zoe Wool. Zoe, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.